you can tell me about yourself. So who are you and what do you do?
So you know my name, of course. I'm Srikant Iyengar. I'm a mathematician at the University of Utah. Actually, I moved there only 3 years ago. I started, you know, I also studied in India. I did until undergraduate, and then I came to the U.S. to do mathematics.
Nice. Where did you do your undergrad?
So I studied at the IIT in Chennai.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah, I studied actually computer science, but then...
Again, this is the perfect segue for so many people. Like every single person I've interviewed up till now says, oh, you know, I did engineering or I did like, you know, some sort of pre-med something. I did biotech engineering. I did computer science engineering. I did mechanical engineering. But hey, you know what? That wasn't interesting at the end of the day.
Yes.
But that's great. I mean, something brought you to mathematics. So what
actually,
happened?
I mean, at least since I was just thinking before you recall what, you know, from what age do I remember being interested? And at least I was interested at least from sixth or fifth standard even.
Wow.
I have memories of my maths teachers and I still have in touch with one of my high school math teachers.
Oh, that's fantastic. That matters so much. I mean, for me as a biologist, I remember all my biology teachers and I, well, if given a chance, I wish I could go back and like, you know, shake their hands and say, thank you so much. So that's cool. So you started being interested in maths around five.
I think, I'm sure I was somehow, you know, there's always, and also that when I had one teacher who was very, and managed to get me excited about it, but I think the turning point somehow was in 11th and 12th. I had an extraordinary man who was, you know, I was preparing for IIT, and I went to this. There was an extraordinary person called Ramaya. Yeah, he has a very. I don't know, really know about his career too much. You know, as a student, you don't inquire about your teacher's career.
Right, which is a shame, right? I mean, I feel like we should know. I mean, I'm sure a lot of our teachers have really inspiring lives. It's just we're never. Maybe it's cultural. I don't know. Maybe it's societal. Yeah. Like we never inquire about our teachers.
So anyway, he somehow had the attitude, you know, most of the time in high school or in engineering, you're preparing to master an exam. You're trying to get through the exam, but that was not his point. He said that you'll do this, but I want you to learn mathematics and let me teach you from the first principles.
Uh-huh.
Still remember his first lecture to us, and he really started, you know, from the Greeks.
Oh, wow. Like really went... Very deep.
Yeah. Very deep. And he really inspired. I think he was very inspiring.
Yeah.
As a teacher, but also as a person.
Mm-hmm.
Because his dedication to mathematics was astounding. So he would, this was tuition. So this was tuition for IIT. So, you know, we would start. And he insisted that we have a tuition at 6 in the morning.
Okay. So, like when your brain is still sort of chugging along, not really awake.
For me, it was not a problem. Somehow we were always getting, you know, in Hyderabad, it gets so hot, you get
up
by 6 anyway. But I had to get a little bit earlier and cycle to his house. And I don't remember what time I'd asked him a question that he couldn't answer. Then I went back home, and 1 hour later, he cycled to my house. Tell me the solution.
that's the kind of teacher you want in your life.
He is very inspiring, actually.
Wonderful. So,
and I met him, actually, he's still alive, and he's 92, and intellectually, I met him just a few months ago. He's in great shape.
That's great.
As sharp as ever. It's amazing to see him.
Yeah. So you finished. So you finished your undergrad in computer science.
Yeah, the only reason I went to computer science because, you know, you take IIT and then you get a rank and then somehow.
Right. You just end up.
But luckily, already in my IIT, I kind of realized 2 years that this is not for me and I should change. In fact, luckily, there was one senior. I had never met him in IIT, but he had switched into mathematics and he had applied to Purdue.
I see.
Among other places, I applied to Purdue and, they accepted me. And I found out why when I went there, because he was a real trailblazer. He was extremely good.
Oh, wow. So you did your PhD in Purdue?
Yeah, Purdue. Yeah, then I immediately switched to mathematics. And since then, I've been doing mathematics.
Excellent. What do you do in Utah now? You're a professor, associate professor?
Yeah, I'm a professor. I finished my PhD in 1998.
Okay.
I traveled a lot. So, I finished my PhD in Purdue. Then I went to postdoc in Missouri. Then I went to England where I had, that was the other good turning point for me, because somehow when I went to England, it was taking a chance. I went to do a postdoc with somebody who works in a different area.
I see.
That turned out to be extremely important for me.
I see.
Academically. I didn't realize it then, but I just did it on a whim,
So what is your area?
So So my area basically is algebra.
Okay.
Fundamentally, it's about algebraic structures, mostly even just polynomials, you know, solutions to polynomial equations. You know, the usual quadratic formula tells you how to solve a quadratic equation.
Right.
What do you do when you have more variables and higher polynomials?
Right.
So then there's a lot of technology developed to study those. And
I see.
I'm sort of studying the algebraic aspects of that. Oh, that's where I started.
Uh-huh.
But my postdoc was at somebody in England and something, he was working in a very different field called topology. And I'll get to that a bit. Yeah, you probably know, bump into this in neuroscience anyway.
Yeah, I mean, we do deal with a little bit of topology, but I would say not so much as an electrophysiologist. A lot of computational modeling people deal with a lot of topology,
yeah.
Because network topology is a really important thing.
Exactly.
in neuroscience, yeah.
So I had 2 years there, and that was also a fantastic breakthrough for me. I mean, lucky for me, break for me, because he was an extremely good mentor. And that sort of changed also my direction of my work a lot.
I see.
Everything that I've done since then has been thanks to somehow those 2 years in Sheffield in some way.
That's fantastic. So my second question was actually, how did you get where you are right now? But I feel like you've answered almost more than 80% of that question. Is there anything else you wanted to add, like a little bit more about your journey and how you went from Madras to here?
Just so happened that when I went to Purdue, there was a new professor who came from Bulgaria, actually. He immigrated to the US.
I see.
6 months before I came to Purdue.
I see. You are a brand new PhD student of a brand new PI. That's really, really cool. I mean, that's a very exciting place to be in, right?
Yeah. I was not as first student. I was a second, but still.
Oh, close.
In the US, yeah.
Yeah. That's really
second.
Cool.
But that was a lucky break, too, because somehow we got along and we still collaborate. I think I have the largest number of collaborations with him.
Fantastic. So, third question. If you could go back in time and explain a scientific concept to yourself, to your younger self, say back in high school or undergrad, what concept would it be and how do you explain it?
Yeah, so this is a tough one.
I know, it always is. I do not envy any one of you. Like, I feel good. I'm happy I'm sitting on this side.
But I was thinking about it, but I'll tell you two things. If time is, there is time. But let me start with one thing, because you said, you know, a little bit of topology, right? I explained this. So let's take a ball,
mm-hmm.
right? A balloon, for example, anything circular. So break it up into triangles, or draw pictures on it to divide it into parts where the sides are all straight lines and they meet at points. So there shouldn't be any overlaps.
Right.
You can easily imagine doing that. So, and what you do is once you do this on the balloon, then on this picture, you'll have a points where these sides meet. These are what you would call vertices.
Exactly.
Right? And then you would have these lines. And then we have faces. We have these triangles, these squares, and whatever else you've drawn.
Right.
If you add the vertices and subtract from it the edges and add the number of faces, no matter how you draw it, you'll always get 2.
Huh.
No. Yeah.
Wow.
So you should try it.
Yeah, I mean, I want to go out and buy a ball now, and I'm going to take a Sharpie and draw on it.
Or you can even draw it on a plane, you know, but just have to imagine, you know, on a circle and then imagine filling it up.
Exactly, yeah.
And it's not so hard to prove it once I tell you. You think about it, you know, you see that if you, whatever pictures you have, you can break it up further into triangles.
Mm-hmm.
Then you see that this process doesn't affect this number. Vertices minus edges plus faces.
I see.
And once someone tells you, one could possibly imagine proving this. But the astonishing thing is, no matter what you do, you always get a 2.
So first of all, does this have a name? Like, does this proof have a name? Is this something I can look up on the internet?
Yeah, I'm telling you is something called Euler's formula. And this number 2 is the Euler characteristic of the ball.
Fantastic.
And if you do the same thing, for example, on a donut.
Uh-huh.
Right? If you take a donut and you can do the same thing, try and break it up and draw. The answer you'll get is 0.
Oh.
To do with the fact that there's a single hole in the donut.
Oh, so that was my second question. I was going to ask you, does it hold for a sphere or can I do it for any three-dimensional object?
Anything, and the answer depends on, roughly speaking, the number of holes. So if you have a 2-hole torus, I don't know if you've seen a fidget spinner, have you?
I have, yes. I've seen it on the internet.
So it's a 2-hole donut. Right.
Right.
So that you would get -2. So it depends on the number of holes. And there is an explicit formula. And this number is called the Euler characteristic of the space.
I see.
So this is the beginnings, roughly speaking, of some field called topology.
Uh-huh.
But this is a fantastic fact that somehow it doesn't really, there's something intrinsic to the space that you're measuring when you're counting this number.
Right. And it holds true, does it differ across different 3D shapes? Like, for example, is the Euler number going to be 2 for a sphere versus a cube versus like a box or a pyramid or something like that?
Very good question. So, yeah, so it really doesn't depend on those. It's really how all these things will have the same Euler number.
Oh.
You're allowed to sort of massage it into whatever shape you like.
Oh, wow. So,
number of a donut will be the same as the Euler number of a coffee cup. This is a standard example because if you have a coffee cup that's
it's a cylinder but it has a handle which has a hole, so it's like a 3D object with a hole.
That's it. So that you would get the same answer to it.
This is
something called Euler's characteristic, and it leads to very deep ideas in something called topology.
You had another concept.
This is something very old, right? This was proved by Euler in the 1700s, and I said it's the beginning of lots of developments in mathematics, physics. It comes up everywhere, and it's numbers you associate to things that they don't. And this number doesn't really depend, as you'd already noticed, on specific shape. It only is, you know, can you deform one into the other, and then the number doesn't change as long as you don't tear or break it.
Right. As long as it's whole, as long as it's entire, your Euler number should be the same.
Yeah, and that's quite astonishing, actually, that it doesn't. The other thing is something that I learned more recently, and I believe this was a problem from somehow raised 2,000 years ago. And it starts very simply. Let's take a square, okay, a square shape. So maybe it's a piece of square slice of bread.
Mm-hmm.
And you want to share it with your friends, but you want to cut it up into triangles.
Okay.
Since you're sharing with friends, you want all the pieces to have equal area.
Yes.
Okay, so if you have a square and you want to cut it up into two equal triangles, it's easy. You just cut it along the diagonal. That's one way to do it. Yeah.
Right.
If you want to cut it into four, you know, you can do it this way and cross. You can do it into six by first cutting the square into three equal parts.
Right.
Three equal rectangles and cutting each rectangle into two equal things, so you get a six.
Correct.
Once I tell you this, you'll see that you can do it for any even number.
Right.
As long as you have an even number of friends, you can into equal areas, right?
That's my goal in life, to get an even number of friends.
Find that extra one.
I know.
And the thing is, can you do it for three friends, five friends, an odd number of friends?
Right.
Turns out that, this is something I'll tell you the answer. It turns out you can never break it up into an odd number.
Huh.
No matter what you try, you can never cut it up into a triangle, three equal area triangles or five equal area triangles.
Does this only apply when you start with a square? Does it apply when you start with any other shape?
So this is something you have to think about. But I think
if you had a triangle, I'm sure you could cut it up into...
Trouble is equal areas, right? If you sort of shrink it, then the
areas... Yeah. So I'm thinking in my head, I'm going, okay, if it's an equilateral triangle and... I find like the centroid or something, and then maybe I can cut it up into three isosceles triangles. But
the thing is a square, right? So
yeah,
originally.
Yeah, so, exactly.
And you needed to break it up into odd number of things, so odd number of equal area triangles.
Right. Huh.
And the surprising thing about this is that unlike the Euler characteristic formula. It was settled only in this 1970, I believe, by someone in Brandeis. And it uses some remarkable piece of mathematics called the p-adic numbers. It uses it in a very elementary way, but just the fact that it uses this. And it's not so hard to explain. If you Google this cutting a square on the web, you'll see various YouTube demonstrations of the proof of this. But the proof is not trivial. It's not something
I would... What are these numbers again? P-adic numbers?
Yeah.
P-I-A-D-I-C.
P is for a prime, hyphen adic, yeah.
Oh,
so in fact, this is only the version for P equal to 2.
Ah.
And the thing is that, what p-adic numbers are, just give you a quick 30-second thing, but you know, like if you start with you have these integers or the rationals, you have a sense of the size, or size of the number is just the number itself, you know, or the absolute value of the number. So size of -2 is 2, or size of -4 and 4 and 4 and but there's a different way to impose a notion of size or what's called a metric on this number system, the rationals, by measuring something. It's called the p-adic periodic measure, and it tells you sort of, it's keeping track of how, if you fix a prime number, say 2, it keeps track of what's the highest power of 2 that divides that number. So the periodic, so if you look at, say, 3, 5, all these odd numbers, so 2 doesn't divide it, so the size is declared to be 1.
Right.
As if you look at 2, the size is declared to be 1 half. For 4, it's 1 over 2 squared, so whatever power of 2.
I see.
6, it would be 1 over 2 because 2 is the highest power that divides. So the more the power of 2 that divides the number, the smaller is the size.
I see.
And turns out this is a perfectly reasonable way to introduce size. It has the expected properties.
Uh-huh.
One can do sort of analysis using this notion of size. And this comes into play in establishing this factor.
It's sort of like, if I may, it's sort of like a tangential number series on top of like the actual number series that we have. Tangential is a bad word for me to use, but tangential as in an alternative number
series? Correct, it's an alternative way of thinking about numbers and their sizes.
I see. And the rules imposed on them are based on whether the number is divisible by 2 or not.
Yeah, so the number system is the same. It's still the integers or the rational numbers,
right,
and you add them the same way. But
we've
introduced a notion of size which is different from what one is used to.
I see.
Even very large numbers can have very small size. It depends just on the power of 2. And this is...
And these sizes are called p-adic sizes. Is that right?
Or norms, yes. Norm is the size.
Norms, I see.
It's just reminding us that it's with respect to the prime p. So this was introduced about 100 years ago in mathematics, and it was someone basically had the idea that you can try to understand numbers. You know, there are all sorts of questions that come up by trying to understand them one prime at a time. Mm. Some of the prime numbers are the building blocks.
Right.
The idea was to analyze things one prime at a time. It's like some spectral analysis, right?
I guess, yeah. But does this mean that they're really making their way down the prime number series? This is potentially non-ending.
true. And the issue is, can you somehow reconstruct what you want by knowing what happens at each prime? But anyway, in this specific problem, all you ever care about is the 2 addicts, what happening at the prime 2. And it's a very clever use of that. And I couldn't explain the proof. It takes a bit of...
not at all. But it's a good gateway to getting into like algebra, and it's a good problem to think about even if you're not a mathematician.
And actually, it's very easy. I mean, it just takes time, but it doesn't take, once somebody tells you the solution, it's easy to follow it.
Right.
So I would encourage people to look online. There are many online, I only bumped into it by accident recently because I got interested in the P addicts for some other reason, but
I see.
It's been known since the 1970s, and there are nice proofs online, you know, very nice videos about this, and it's easy even for high school students. You know, you don't need any mathematical training to understand this.
Right.
But it's again a starting point of a very deep and long journey into mathematics.
Fantastic! That is precisely what I'm looking for the series. So thank you very, very much. This is great. I'm not a person who loves maths, but you've actually managed to get me interested in something. Now I'm going to go back and I'm going to look up p-adic numbers now.
This cutting a square, that's what you should look for.
Yes, definitely.